building west of Nuuanu, where a meeting was in progress, attended by elderly Japanese. A fanatical religious leader, recently out of a concentration camp, was shouting in Japanese, "What they tell you about Hiroshima is all lies. The city was not touched. Tokyo was not burned. Our troops are in Singapore and Australia. Japan is more powerful than ever before." The audience listened intently, and Shigeo saw his brother-in-law, Mr. Ishii, nodding profoundly. At this moment, Shigeo unfortunately tugged at his sister's sleeve, and the speaker saw him. "Ah," he shouted, "I see we have a spy in our midst, a dirty dog of the enemy. You, Mrs. Ishii, is he trying to tell you that Japan lost the war? Don't you believe him. He has been bought by the Americans. I tell you, he is a liar and a spy. Japan won the war." Against his own intelligence, Shigeo had to admit that many of the audience not only believed this crazy religious maniac, but they wanted to believe. When the meeting ended, many of the old people smiled sadly at Shigeo, who had criminally fought against Japan, and they hoped that when the emperor's troops landed, they would deal kindly with him, for he had probably been seduced into his traitorous action. Many boys in Hawaii had been so tricked. In a daze, Shigeo started homeward. He wanted no more to do with Mr. Ishii and the pathetic old fools. But when he had walked some distance, he changed his mind and caught a bus that carried him down into the heart of Honolulu. And after some speculation as to what he should do, he marched into the police station and asked to see one of the detectives. The haole knew him and congratulated him on his medals, but Shig laughed and said, "What I'm going to tell you, you may take them away." "What's up?" "You ever hear of the Katagumi Society, the ever-victorious group?" "You mean the Japan One screwballs?" "Yeah, we keep a fairly close watch on them." "I just attended a meeting. Captain, I'm shook." "The little hut back of the old mission school?" "Yes. We check that regularly. Tony, did we have a man at the mission hut tonight?" "We didn't bother tonight," the assistant replied. "These people are out of their minds," Shig protested. "It's pathetic," the detective agreed. "Poor old bastards, they were so sure Japan couldn't be licked that they believe whatever these agitators tell them, but they don't do any harm." "Aren't you going to arrest them?" Shig asked. "Hell no," the detective laughed. "We got 6 groups in Honolulu we check on regularly, and the Japan Ones give us the least trouble. One group wants to murder Syngman Rhee. One wants to murder Chiang Kai-shek. One dupes old women out of all their money by predicting the end of the world on the first of each month. Last year, we had one couple that prepared for the second coming of Christ on the first day of 11 succeeding months. They finally came to us and said that maybe something was wrong, so your crazy Japanese are only part of a pattern." "But how can they believe all the newspaper stories and newsreels, the men who were there?" "Shig," the detective said, plopping his hands upright on the desk, "how can you believe for 11 successive months that Jesus Christ is coming down the Nuuanu Pali? You can be fooled once, I grant, but not 11 times." When the time came for Shigeo to sail to his new job with General MacArthur in Japan, his mother wept and said, "If there is fighting when you get to Tokyo, don't get off the ship, Shigeo." Then, recalling more important matters, she told him, "Don't marry a northern girl, Shigeo. We don't want any Zuzu Ben in our family. And I'd be careful of Tokyo girls, too. They're expensive. Your father and I would be very unhappy if you married a Kyushu girl, because they don't fit in with Hiroshima people. And under no circumstances marry an Okinawan or anyone who might be an Eta. What would be best would be for you to marry a Hiroshima girl, such girls you can trust. But don't take one from Hiroshima City." "I don't think Americans will be welcomed in Hiroshima," Shigeo said quietly. "Why not?" his mother protested. "After the bomb?" Shigeo asked. "Shigeo," his mother replied in amazement, "nothing happened to Hiroshima. Mr. Ashii assured me. When Shig Sakagawa assembled with his Tokyo-bound outfit and marched through the streets of downtown Honolulu on his way to the transport that would take them to Yokohama, he was, without knowing it, a striking young man. He possessed a mind of steel, hardened in battle against both the Germans and the prejudices of his homeland. By personal willpower, he had triumphed against each adversary and had proved his courage as few men are required to do. No one recognized the fact that day, for then Shig was only 23 and had not yet acquired his lawyer's degree from Harvard. But he was the forward, cutting edge of a revolution that was about to break over Hawaii. He was stern, incorruptible, physically hard, and fearless. More important, so far as revolutions go, he was well-organized and alert. As he marched, he passed, without either man's knowing it, Hawksworth Hale, who was walking up Bishop Street on his way to the fort. And if in that moment Hale had had the foresight to stop the parade and to enlist Shig Sakagawa on his side, the fort would surely have been able to preserve its prerogatives. Furthermore, if Hale, as an official of the Republican Party, had conscripted Shig and half a hundred other young Japanese like him, Republicanism in Hawaii would have been perpetually insured, for by their traditional and conservative nature, the Japanese would have made ideal Republicans. And a combination of Hanle business acumen and Japanese industry would have constituted a strength that no adversary could have broken. But it was then totally impossible for Hawksworth Hale even to imagine such a union, and as he walked past the parade, he had the ungracious thought, "If I hear any more about the brave Japanese boys who won the war for us, I'll vomit. Where's my son Bromley? Where's Harry Janders and Jimmy Whipple? They won the war too, and they're dead." The crowd along Bishop Street cheered the Japanese boys, and the pregnant moment of history was lost. Hawksworth Hale went to the fort, and Shig Sakagawa went to Japan. But if Hawksworth Hale failed to grasp the nettles of history, there was another who did. For as Hong Kong Ki walked down Bishop Street in the other direction, he met Kamajiro Sakagawa, proudly waving to his son. And Hong Kong asked, "Which one is your boy, Kamajiro?" "That one over there with the medals," Kamajiro beamed. Since most of the Japanese were wearing medals won in Europe, Hong Kong could not determine which one was Kamajiro's son. "Is he the one who has the red patch on his arm?" Hong Kong asked. "Hi," old Sakagawa agreed. "I'd like to meet your boy," Hong Kong said. And when the troops broke ranks on the dock, Kamajiro said to his son, "This Hong Kong Ki, very good friend, he give me the money for the store." With obvious gratitude, Captain Sakagawa thrust out his hand and said, "You had a lot of courage, Mr. Ki, to gamble that way on my father, especially during the war." Hong Kong was tempted to bask in glory, but prudence had taught him always to anticipate trouble and to quash it in advance. So he said forthrightly, "Probably you didn't hear, but during the war I was stupid enough to make a very bad speech against the Japanese. Later, I was ashamed of myself and tried to make up." "I know," Shig said. "My sister wrote me about your speech. But war is war." "Things are much better now," Hong Kong said. "What I wanted to see you about, Shigeo. When you come home, you ought to go to college, maybe law school. You do well, maybe I'll have a job for you." "You have a lot of sons of your own, Hong Kong." "None of them is Japanese," Hong Kong laughed. "You want a Japanese?" Shig asked, astounded. "Of course," Hong Kong grunted. "You boys are going to run the islands." Shig grew extraordinarily attentive. Standing directly in front of Hong Kong's metallic eyes, he studied the Chinese carefully and asked, "Do you really think there'll be changes?" "Fantastic," Hong Kong replied. "I'd like to have a smart boy like you working for me." "I may not work for anybody," Shig said slowly. "That's good too," Hong Kong said evenly. "But everybody's got to have friends." When Captain Sakagawa climbed aboard the transport, he felt completely American. He had proved his courage, had been accepted by Honolulu, and now he was wanted by someone. In a sense, he was already a golden man, knowledgeable both in Western and Eastern values. For, although he reveled in his newly won Americanism, he also took pride in being a pure-blooded Japanese. Of course, this latter was ridiculous, for he contained inheritances from all those nameless predecessors who had once inhabited Japan. Some of his genes came from the hairy Ainu to the north, from Siberian invaders, from the Chinese, from the Koreans amongst whom his ancestors had lived, and more particularly from that venturesome Indo-Malayan stock, half of whom had journeyed eastward to become Hawaiians, while their brothers had moved northward along different islands to merge with the Japanese. Thus, of two ancient Malayan brothers starting from a point near Singapore, the northern traveler had become the ancestor of Shigeo Sakagawa, while the other had served as the progenitor of Kelly Kanakoa, the Hawaiian beach boy, who now stood with a pretty girl watching the end of the parade. Or, if one preferred looking north, of three ancient Siberian brothers, one bravely crossed the sea to Japan, where his genes found ultimate refuge in the body of Shigeo Sakagawa. Another crept along the Aleutian Bridge toward Massachusetts, where his descendants wound up as Indian progenitors of Hawksworth Hale. While a third, less venturesome than his brothers, drifted southward along established land routes to central China, where he helped form the Hakka, thus serving as an ancestor to Hong Kong Ki. In truth, all men are brothers. But as generations pass, it is differences that matter, and not similarities. In the irrelevant sense of the word, this Kelly Kanakoa of whom I just spoke was already a golden man. For at 21, he was slightly over 6 feet tall, weighed a trim 180, and had a powerful body, whose muscles rippled in sunlight as if smeared with coconut oil. He was very straight and had unusually handsome features, marked by deep-set dark eyes, a gammon laugh, and a head of jet-black hair in which he liked to wear a flower. His manner was a mixture of relaxation and insolence, and although it was more than 2 years since he had knocked out two sailors on Hotel Street for calling him a nigger, he seemed always half ready for a brawl. But whenever one seemed about to explode, he tried to evade it. "Why you like beef with me? I no want trouble. Let's shake and be balalas again." Now, as Kelly stood watching the departing parade, he held in his right hand the slim, well-manicured fingers of a Tulsa divorcee who had come to Honolulu from Reno, seeking emotional reorientation after her difficult divorce. At the ranch where she had stayed in Nevada, a fellow divorcee had told her, "Rennie, if you go to Hawaii, be sure to look up Kelly Kanakoa. He's adorable." So, as soon as Rennie had disembarked from the H&H flagship Mauna Loa, she had called the number her friend had given her, announcing, "Hello, Kelly. Maud Clemens told me to look you up." He had come sauntering around to the luxurious H&H hotel, the Lagoon, wearing very tight blue pants, a white busboy's jacket with only one button closed, sandals, a yachting cap, and a flower behind his ear. When she came down into the grandiose lobby, crisp and white in a new bathing suit edged in lace, he appraised her insolently and calculated, "This Vahini's gonna screw the first night." In his job as beach boy, which he had acquired by accident because he liked to surf and had a pleasant joking way with rich women customers, he had become expert in estimating how long it would take him to get into bed with any newcomer. Divorcees, he had found, were easiest because they had undergone great shock to their womanliness and were determined to prove that they at least had not been at fault in the breakup of their marriages. It rarely took Kelly more than 2 nights. Of course, when they first met him, they certainly had no intention of sleeping with him. But, as he explained to the other fellows hanging around the beach, "Suppose Dabahini not ride a surfboard yet. How she know what she really want to do?" It was his job, and he got paid for it, to take divorcees and young widows on surfboards. 10 minutes after Rennie met Kelly, she was on her first surfing expedition, far out on the reef where the big waves were forming. She was excited by the exhilarating motion of the sea and felt that she would never be able to rise and stand on the board as it swept her toward shore. But when she felt Kelly's strong arms enveloping her from the rear, she felt assured. And as the board gathered momentum, she allowed herself to be pulled upright, always in Kelly's stout arms, until she stood daringly on the flying board. For a moment the spray blinded her, but she soon learned to tilt her chin high into the wind and break its force, so that soon she was roaring across the reef, with a thundering surf at her feet and the powerful shape of Diamond Head dominating the shore. "How marvelous!" she cried, as the comber maintained its rush toward the shore. Instinctively, she drew Kelly's arm closer about her, pressed backward against him, and reveled in his manliness. Then, when the crashing surf broke at last, she felt the board collapse into the dying waves, and she with it, until she was underwater, with Kelly's arm still about her. And of her own accord she turned her face to his, and they kissed for a long time under the sea, then idly rose to the surface. Now she climbed back upon the surfboard, and with Kelly instructing, started the long paddle out to catch the next wave. But when their board was well separated from the others, she relaxed backwards until she felt herself against the beach boy once more, and there she rested in his secure arms, paddling idly as his adept hands began their explorations beneath her new bathing suit. Sighing, she whispered, "Is this part of the standard instruction?" "Not many Vahini cute like you," Kelly replied gallantly. Whereupon she shivered with joy and brought her body closer to his, where she could feel the muscles of his chest against her neck. It was a long, exciting trip out to where the waves formed, and as they waited for the right one, Kelly asked, "You scared stand up this time?" "I'm game to try anything with you," Rennie said, and she showed remarkable aptitude on the long surge in. And when the surfboard finally subsided into the broken wave, and when they were underseas for a kiss, she found to her surprise that her hands were now inside his swimming suit, clutching passionately, hungrily. When they surfaced, his black hair in his eyes like a setter's, he laughed and said approvingly, "Bye-bye, you number one surfer. Get the trophy, Rennie." "Do I do things right?" she asked modestly. "You very right," he assured her. "Shall we catch another wave?" she suggested. "Why we not go on up your room?" he asked evenly, keeping his dark eyes directly on her. "I think we'd better," she agreed, adding cautiously, "Are you allowed upstairs? S'pose you forget your Lahala hat on the beach. Somebody surely got to bring it to you," he explained. "Is that standard procedure?" Rennie asked coyly. "Like most stuff," Kelly explained, "surfin's got to have its own rules." "We'll play by the rules," she agreed, squeezing his hand. And when he got to her room, holding the sun hat in his powerful hands, he found that she had already climbed into one of the skimpiest playsuits he had ever seen, and in his years on the beach he had seen quite a few. "Hey, sister, whether you wear moo-moo or sundress or nothing, you look beautiful," he said approvingly. And in her natural confusion over her divorce, this was exactly what she wanted to hear. And she dispensed with the customary formalities of such moments and held out her arms to the handsome beach boy. "Normally, I'd order a scotch and soda and we'd talk a while. Let's take up where we left off underwater." Kelly studied her for a long, delicious moment and suggested, "All the time, these bathing suit get wet too much," and he slipped his off. And when he stood before her in rugged, dark-skinned power, she thought, "If I had married a man like this, there'd have been no trouble." Now, as the parade passed down Bishop Street, she was about to leave Hawaii, and she held his hand tightly in the last minutes before boarding the Mauna Loa. For 9 days she had lived with Kelly passionately, and in complete surrender to his amazing manliness. Once she told him, "Kelly, You should have seen the pathetic little jerk I was married to. God, what a waste of years. Now, she whispered in the bright sunlight, if we hurried to the ship, would we have time for one more? What's the matter, why not? He asked. And they clambered aboard the big ship and sought out her stateroom. But her intended roommate was already unpacking, a tall, rather good-looking girl in her late 20s. There were several embarrassed moments, after which Rennie whispered to Kelly, what have I got to lose? She addressed the girl directly and said, I'm sorry we haven't met, but would you think me an awful stinker if I borrowed the room for a little while? The tall girl slowly studied Rennie, and then Kelly. They were an attractive couple, and she laughed. A vacation's a vacation. How long you need? About half an hour, Rennie replied. They have a band upstairs. And a full orchestra right here, the girl laughed. And before she had climbed to the next deck, Rennie was undressed and in bed. Later, she confided, For 5 days, I've been imagining what it would be like to have you back in New York. How old are you, Kelly? 21. Damn, I'm 27. You no seem 27 yet, not in bed, the beach boy assured her. Am I good in bed? She pleaded. Really good? You number one vahini. Have you known many girls? Surfin' is surfin', he replied. For example, Maud Clemens. Did you sleep with her? How you like, s'pose next week somebody asked me, how about Rennie, dat vahini screw? Kelly, such words. The whistle gonna blow, Rennie Sista, he warned her, climbing into his own clothes. I went down to the library, Kelly, she said softly, and there it was, like you said, this big long book with the names written down by the missionary. It says that your family can be traced back for 134 generations. It must make you feel proud. Don't make me feel nothing, Kelly grunted. Why does a Hawaiian have the name Kelly? She asked, slipping on her stockings. My Kanaka name Kololo, but nobody likes Sayem. Kelly's a sweet name, she said approvingly. Then she kissed him and asked, Why wouldn't you take me to your home? It's nothing, he shrugged. You mean your ancestors were kings and you have nothing for yourself? I get guitar, I get surfboard, I get cute vahini like you. It's too damn bad, she said bitterly, kissing him again. Kelly, you're the best thing in Hawaii. They went on deck, and she made a quick sign to her roommate, thanking her. The tall girl laughed and winked. When the whistle blew for the last time, warning the various beach boys who had come down,